We haven't quite done with chapter 16 yet. This is just part 3, and next week we should be able to complete the last section of this chapter. To recap, chapter 16 has been analyzed under 4 captions, which we have covered over the last 3 weeks. Verses 1 through 4 is captioned Miserable Comforters, How Not to Be a Counselor. And we spent a fair bit of time discussing what can go wrong when we try to perform counseling with good intention but with not sufficient understanding of what can go wrong. And that led to verse 5, which we considered alone. We called it the golden rule of counseling. Today we want to look at verses 6 through 18, which is captioned Job's tragic plight. Why so? Because God and the world seem to conspire against him. And next week we do the last section, verses 19 through 22, where we see that despite everything that is working against Job, and though he plunges into the depths of despair, his inner faith, the strength of his true faith, is seen in the fact that somehow he is able to rise up and reaffirm his confidence and trust that God, his God, will vindicate him. So today it is the tragic plight of Job, where both God and the world seem to conspire to work together against him. We start first with verses 10 and 11. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. They have gathered themselves together against me. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. If you compare this with the section that went before, we see immediately there is a change from the singular personal pronoun to the plural, the they. And that is not trivial, that is rather significant. So we need to ask, who is Job referring to in the plural? Natural presumption is, oh, it must refer to the three friends, to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But consider what is this, if they are the persons described or subsumed under the personal pronoun they, would this description apply to them? Did they gape upon Job with their mouth? Not really, they were taken aback, but don't forget that they sat down with him in silence to commiserate with him. So they didn't just gape upon him as a spectacle. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. That means two things. In ancient culture, to express contempt, there were two actions involved. Smite the cheek of the person that you despise and follow that up by hurling verbal insults. So when you read this phrase, they have smitten the cheek reproachfully, bear in mind it is both the physical action followed up by the verbal insults. Did the friends smite Job on the cheek? No. Did they hurl verbal insults at him? No. They criticized him, but that's not the same as insulting him. They have gathered themselves together against me. Does that apply to the three friends? Yes and no. In a sense, they seem to gang up against him. But really, they were just following, Bildad and Zophar were following the lead of Eliphaz in trying with good intention to get Job to confess his guilt and get this ordeal over with. So they were not really ganged up against him. So it doesn't apply to them either. God has delivered me to the ungodly, turned me over into the hands of the wicked. That is really not true of the three friends, because the scripture describes them as wise men. of the similar stature to Job, maybe not up to the same level of spirituality, but they were honest, upright, decent folk. Therefore, the they cannot refer to the three friends. Who would it refer to then? To understand that, we must take stock of Job's actual condition. The moment he became stricken with this kind of disfiguring skin disease, we do not know what it was. Some commentators speculate it may have been elephantiasis, where the lower limbs swell up to gigantic size. Others suppose it was a form of leprosy. But in either case, the common practice was that such a person had to be put in quarantine. And the way the person was put in quarantine was he was forced to get out of the city, stay out of the city until he recovered. And if he couldn't recover, too bad for him. He would live and die outside. Somebody would take food and water to him so he would have his meals, but he would have to be isolated. And in those times, this was only logical, because not knowing the real cause of disease and fearing that the contagion would spread to the whole community, this was a natural response to protect the community as a whole. So he had to be put in quarantine, which means that he had to stay out of the city gates. The only place that was outside the city and yet near enough to belong to the city was the refuse dump, the garbage dump. So Job was really seated on the refuse dump outside the city gate, which means that whoever went out of the city or whoever headed to the city and wanted to pass through the gate would for sure encounter this strange, deformed, diseased man sitting on the refuse dump. And that being the case, and seeing the hideous deformity of his body and the sores on his skin, they would naturally gape at him, and they would assume, as it was the practice in those times, that somebody stricken in this way was under divine judgment and therefore deserving of being spat upon or being reproached, and they would show their contempt by striking the cheek. So whether they were godly or ungodly, travelers heading to the city or city dwellers heading out would for sure encounter the spectacle of Job, and they would show their contempt for him. So the they refers to the society at large. Why should this matter to Job? If so long as he knew, so long as we know that we are in the right, we tell ourselves, why should it matter if we are misunderstood or despised by the people around us? True, it shouldn't matter. We should be above those considerations. But bear in mind that we are all too human, and it is a central characteristic of human nature that it draws its sense of dignity, its sense of worth from the approbation, from the approval of the society in which that person lives. For example, take a concert pianist. It is the Polish pianist Zimmermann is widely regarded as the most gifted pianist on the concert circuit today. What would his response be if he strides upon the stage expecting a grand audience to welcome him, and then as he turns to face the audience, he sees 11 people sitting in the grand concert hall, and out of the 11, only one of them is clapping for him, and that person happens to be his mother, so it's not counted at all. So 10 people, would he be able to play to the same level of skill and emotion and passion as he would if the entire hall were filled. Theoretically, he should. In practice, he would not measure up, because like all human beings, he derives his sense of worth from the recognition, from the approval of the society in which he lives. God made man to be a social animal, not to live in isolation. And therefore, this is, you cannot despise Job for seeking the approval of his society, because this is part and parcel of what it is to be a human being. Now comes an interesting question. As we read verses 10 and 11, we realize that there are specific expressions in these two verses that call to mind specific events in the life of Christ. For example, gaped upon me with their mouth. Did they not do that to Christ? Smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. They did that. They not only smote him on the cheek, they hurled insults at him. They have gathered themselves together against me. Did not the scribes and Pharisees conspire against him? So there are expressions in these two verses which call to mind similar events in the life of Christ. So we might be tempted to conclude from this similarity that perhaps Job was a type of Christ. And as this is a very important consideration, we have to address it before we move on. Was Job, in fact, a type of Christ? And just by a show of hands, may I ask how many sincerely believe that Job was a type of Christ? Anyone believes it to be so? Or no one is quite sure? Perhaps. I personally believe that we cannot conclude from this description in verses 10 and 11 that Job was a type of Christ. Having said that, I have to justify my claim. In order to do that, we have to define the terms that are used to describe the types of Christ. And they are listed for you on the board. I'll run through them quickly. The first word in Greek to take note of is tupos, from which we get the word, English word, type. Best example would be Adam as a tupos of Christ. Romans chapter 5 verse 14. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Who, that is Adam, is the figure of him, Christ, that was to come. So we see here how a type points specifically to Christ. Second word that is used when we discuss types is the word skia, which means in English shadow, and one such example is to be found in Colossians chapter 2 verse 17, where certain elements of the mosaic system, the sacrificial system, are said to be a shadow of things to come. The third word in Greek to take note of is hupodigyuma, which means in English an adumbration. What is an adumbration? It is a pattern of something that occurs earlier in time and points forward to what is to come. And one example of the use of this term is Hebrews chapter 9 verse 23. It was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with this. And the third Greek term to take note of in discussing types is hyperbole, which means literally a figure, a representation. Hebrews chapter 9 verse 9, which was a figure for the time then present in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices, that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. So because it could not serve its intended purpose, it was nevertheless performed. The sacrifices were performed because they were performed in faith, as signifying the person who was to come in the distant future, who would fulfill that substitutionary atonement of which this sacrificial system was only a representation in time, in earlier time. So if these terms apply to the type, then what is the antitype? The antitype is the fulfillment in the New Testament of that which is pointed to in the Old Covenant. So we are clear about the type and the antitype. Now we need a working definition of type. And there are many such definitions that you have come across. Here is one that I have put together that suits my own way of looking at things. A type is an event or a person or a thing or a set of practices in the Old Testament that God had ordained as a prophetic sign pointing to its fulfillment under the New Covenant, specifically in Jesus Christ. So we have now the terms, we have the definition, the working definition of type, and now we have to consider this one other point. What agent is it that instituted a specific type to antitype link? Clearly, the only agent, the only person who could institute that kind of link is God Himself. So if it is God and God alone who institutes a type antitype link, all the latitude we have amounts simply to this: to discern the link as and when we come across it. To discern the link rules out all personal speculation. We have no liberty, no latitude to speculate on what constitutes in the Old Testament a type, because God has already specifically ordained the type-antitype link, and He has indicated it in Scripture by very clear signs. And all that is left for us to do is to be discerning, to see that link. So there is no room for speculation. That will put paid to so much of abuse of this concept of type. Go back to the description in verses 10 and 11. As mentioned, at first reading, this description of the indignities suffered by Job bears a superficial resemblance to what Christ had suffered. But there is nothing in the context of Job to indicate in any way that this pointed specifically to Christ in the New Testament. Therefore, I submit that what we are seeing in verses 10 and 11 is not evidence for a type, but clear evidence for a parallelism, a similarity, but it is not a type. So we have actually completed that important discussion. So bear in mind, for the purposes of this study, we are taking it that Job, though many aspects of his experiences resemble what Christ had to endure, Job was not, in the strictest sense of the word, a type of Christ. Next, verses 12, 13, and 14 are full of metaphors. Whenever we come across a passage that abounds in metaphors, it signals that the person involved is undergoing or experiencing some very profound emotion or undergoing an emotional upheaval. And this naturally is expressed in the form of metaphors. So when you read verses 12, 13 and 14, they are full of very graphic metaphors. Consider, I was at ease, but he has broken me asunder. He had also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. His archers compass me round about. He cleaveth my reins asunder and doth not spare. He poureth out my gall upon the ground. He breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. The imagery used in these three verses is intensely vivid, and as mentioned, they signify very profound emotion in Job. In other words, he is reaching the very bottom of his despair, and his cry to God is rising to a crescendo, having been built up from the initial stages. As disaster after disaster fell upon him and his sufferings increased, we find his desperation, his emotional turmoil also rising to a peak. And that is signaled, is flagged by this abundance of metaphors in just these three verses. To understand them, we'll have to tear them apart bit by bit. I was at ease. Here is a contrast. He's saying that he had been enjoying divine blessings in abundance, and those blessings he richly deserved. He knew it, and the people around him knew that he richly deserved the blessings which he was experiencing. I was at ease. Therefore, when the satanic attack came, he was totally unprepared for it. And it is very characteristic of Satan that he attacks when we are least expected, because this is an extremely effective and always successful strategy, the surprise attack. When you least expect it, the enemy attacks. It's exactly this strategy that motivated the Egyptians to attack Israel on the day of Yom Kippur in 1967. The last day in the year that the Israelis ever expected the enemy would attack. They expected the enemy, being themselves of the monotheistic religion, would respect the Yom Kippur and not attack. So this army was not out in force at all. They were at home observing the sanctity of Yom Kippur, and the attack came, which is why Israel was almost wiped out. So this kind of attack, the surprise attack, is extremely effective and usually successful. So in the case of Job, remember that the bounds of the satanic, the scope of the satanic attack had been defined or limited by God. But that did not alleviate the suddenness and the ferocity of the attack when it came. So sudden was it, so fierce was it, that Job was completely shattered. So this experience of his is conveyed in these verses by three specific metaphors which we will now consider. The first metaphor is this: he hath also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. Note first that the Hebrew word that is rendered neck in the Authorized Version is oreth, which really means the nape, N-A-P-E, which is the back of the neck. Picture a strong man who grips Job from behind, so he's unprepared, and grips him by the nape and holds him up like a chicken and punches him and shatters him. And because he's hammered from behind, Job, even if he wants to defend himself physically, his arms will be flailing all over the place. The attacker is behind. So he's totally helpless. He's pummeled and beaten. Can you see the power of the imagery conveyed by just this one word, this one expression? An example of the usage of Oreb is found in Genesis 49 verse 8. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck, Oreb, of thine enemies. So that is the first metaphor that Job uses. The second metaphor, his archers compass me round about, is that of being set up as a target for a large, bear in mind this, it's not a small band. The context requires that the band of archers be a very large company of archers. Why is that important? Because it goes on to say, compass me round about. There were enough archers completely to surround Job. Why is that important? You will see in a minute. And these archers were the equivalent of today's snipers. So, given that skill and given the fact that the archers, there are sufficient of them completely to surround Job, when they let off volley after volley of arrows, it is from all directions and there is no escaping this rain of arrows. Very powerful picture. His archers compass me round about. Next expression to consider related to the same metaphor, he cleaveth my reins asunder. Notice the two words, cleaveth and asunder. In Hebrew, it is the same word that is used. The word is palak, which literally means pierce right through or split open. Think of the way you would split open a durian to get at the kernel. You whack at it in whatever way you can because you're so desperate to get to the juicy fruit. But essentially all you want is, whether it's neatly done or crudely done, you just want to split the fruit open. And this is the image that applies when we come across the Hebrew word palak. It is splitting open, whatever way possible, just get the guts out. And what in Job's weakened body is being pierced through by the arrows of God's snipers? We are told that it is his reins, in Hebrew, kilia, which literally means the kidneys. Kidneys considered as a vital organ. As a result of the kidneys being pierced through, the bile in the kidneys came out of his mouth and spilled onto the ground. And this itself is a metaphor within a metaphor, because bile, which incidentally in Hebrew is merera, is a metaphor. When the bile is poured out, it is a metaphor for a mortal wound from which there is no recovery. Example of the use of bile as a metaphor, Lamentations chapter 2 verse 11. Mine eyes do fail with tears, my bowels are troubled, my liver is poured upon the earth. That of course is the English rendition, but the way it is rendered in the AV actually is very interesting, because it is a metaphor within what is itself a metaphor. My liver is poured out really means that the bile in the liver, as in the kidneys, is poured out. There is no recovery. It is a mortal wound. So that's the second metaphor that Job uses. The third metaphor that he uses, he likens God to a formidable warrior who deploys his strength against a fortified city. And having arranged his troops, he sends them in wave upon wave to try and breach the walls. And because there are so many of them, that they can keep up a relentless barrage. And at some point, the walls are going to weaken and going to give way. So eventually, the defenses of that city are breached. So this giant that is referred to in the verse, he breaketh me with breach upon breach, he runneth upon me like a giant. What must come to your mind is this picture of a mighty warrior marshalling his troops and sending them against the fortified city until the defenses are breached. Given these metaphors, what Job is saying through these metaphors is God has done this, and at this point in time I am broken. There's nothing I can do. I have no energy left even to speak up in my defense. As a result, we see what he does in verse 15. As a result of being broken, yes, his own conscience tells him that he is innocent, but the severity of the attacks upon him, the relentless pursuit of him, seemingly a relentless pursuit by God, for whatever reason is not clear, has finally broken him. Has not broken his faith, he has not cursed God, so he is still holding out on that last bit of his integrity, and he will never give that up. You will see that. But virtually everything else has been effectively by this time broken, shattered. So what is left is the shell of the man. And to indicate that profound grief and brokenness, what does he do in verse 15? I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my horn in the dust. You probably realize that the wearing of sackcloth was customary to express profound grief or mourning. You normally put it on, but in Job's case, his body had become so deformed, his skin so hideous, ulcers dried up with scabs on them, ulcers still fresh, oozing away, that he had to have the sackcloth specially sewn so as tightly to wrap itself around the body. The idea being to hide that hideous body completely. If it were just an outer garment thrown on, you can conceive of a situation where if a strong wind were to blow, the garment would open up and expose his skin. So to prevent that happening and shocking the people who might be passing by, this sackcloth had to be sewn, custom-made sackcloth, to fit tightly around him. When you have ulcerated skin and you try wearing sackcloth, I guarantee that within 2 seconds you will be screaming your head off. And here is this man, day and night, waking or sleeping, his whole body ulcerated, but necessarily covered with a tightly fitting robe of sackcloth. It is an indication of how great is his grief, how profound is his mourning. And he doesn't stop there. He goes a step further to humble himself under the chastening of God. Bear in mind that the most painful part of this all is the fact that he knows, his conscience testifies, that he is innocent. He does not have any unconfessed sin in his life, and it is this which makes the suffering so much greater. And yet he does not curse God, but he goes, he says, if I can't put forward a case that God would accept as proof of my innocence, I can only hide myself in the dust. And that is literally what he does. I have defiled my horn in the dust. The word defiled there is the Hebrew alal, which has an intensive form, meaning to say that when it is carried out or executed, it is done with great thoroughness. So what does this mean in the case of the present context? It means he didn't just bow down and touch his forehead to the ground and get some of the dirt onto his forehead, but to express his humiliation, he buried his face in the dust of the ground. And because he was sitting on a dung heap, the dust that he gathered around him is not the kind of dust that you and I would want to smell. But he, as indicated by the intensive form of the Hebrew word alal, he didn't just bow down and just get the dust on his head. He burrowed his head into the dust of the dung heap, the garbage heap, until his whole head was covered with a thick layer of that filthy dust. This was a mark of his abject humiliation. He's telling God, I know I'm innocent, but I am not going to fight my case. If you want me broken like this, let me be broken. As for horn, you know that it symbolizes his honor, dignity, and strength. So Job is furthermore saying that his honor, dignity, and strength, which are hallmarks of him, he has surrendered this all. Verse 16, my face is foul, that word needs to be explained. My face is foul with weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. The word foul is interesting because it is the rendition in the Authorized Version. But if you look at the Hebrew text, the basic word is kama, which means literally to boil over. Or it could also signify to glow red, that is to appear reddened. You know by personal experience that if you cry continuously for any length of time, invariably your face appears very reddened and inflamed. And of course, the fairer you are, the more obvious it becomes. So in this context, what Job is saying is not so much his face is foul in the sense that it is stinking, but it is foul in the sense that his intense and protracted crying has left his face reddened. Why did the KJV translators use the word foul? I honestly do not know. They must have had some very good reason, but as the notes of their translators, of the translators, haven't survived, we can only speculate. But if you go back to the literal Hebrew, it refers to the reddening of the face, which is consonant with a protracted period of crying. The next metaphor in verse 16, is here again is a verse full of metaphors. The first half is a metaphor, my face is foul with weeping. Second half is another very well-known metaphor, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. It's obvious that this was used to signal impending death. Why is it an interesting expression? Because this idea of using or representing impending death by the description of the shadow of death falling on my eyelids was an expression that was used in ancient secular literature also. And one good example would be the Greek epic poet Homer, in his epic poem The Iliad, in book 13, lines 675 to 677, which I read to you in English translation. That is how Adamas once hit, twitched there for a while, that is on the ground, But not for long. Warlike Meriones, running up, yanked out his spear. Then darkness covered up his eyes. The writer does not mention in literal terms that Adonis lay on the ground, having been hit once, his body was twitching, and his opponent Meriones yanked out his spear and plunged his spear. That is too simplistic and too obvious. So the writer, being a great poet, represents the coming of death by understating the case. He stops at that point, warlike Meriones running up, yanked out his spear, and we are wondering what's going to happen next. And instead of what we expect to hear or see, that he plunged his spear into the person on the ground, we suddenly find like a let down, darkness covered his eyes. So the impact upon the reader is even greater. It signifies the coming of death upon the person. So this expression was often used in ancient literature, particularly in poetry. On my eyelids is the shadow of death. And verse 17 highlights the fact, not for any injustice in mine hand. Again, Job is maintaining his innocence, implying that his sufferings therefore were unjustified. And he also goes on to say, my prayer is pure, emphasizing the fact that his worship of God had not been hypocritical, had been sincere through and through. So really, on both fronts, I have not done anything wrong which I haven't confessed to God. My worship of God has not been a matter of just going through the ceremonies, but it has been a worship from the heart, the only kind of worship that is acceptable to God. So what Job is saying is, on every count, examine me how you will, I am innocent. And because of that, he ends this section in verse 18 with a very interesting metaphor, twin metaphor. O earth, cover not thou my blood, and let my cry have no place. O earth, on the face of it, he is appealing to the earth as a witness or a support. And to understand why, we must appreciate the fact that in scripture, such appeals to the earth indicated or flagged great emotion on the part of the speaker. So Job was totally serious, dead serious in what he was going to say. And he's calling on earth to be his support and witness. And there's no other support and no other witness around. Even God has forsaken him. Earth, you are a neutral party. You are not involved in anything. You have observed everything that goes on. Just like we use in English the expression, these walls have ears. Likewise, O earth, you are the silent observer of all that has gone on in my life. Cover not thou my blood. Now that needs a little explanation. On the face of it, Job is simply calling on the earth not to soak up his blood. And why is that important to him? Because the idea was this. If an innocent man's blood were to be shed, the idea was that it should not soak into the ground and be lost. It should remain on the ground. Why should the blood of an innocent man remain on the ground? So that it would be a marker, a memorial, a reminder for the avenger of blood to take action to vindicate the innocent person who has just suffered and died. So for Job, since he believed he was going to die anyway, he called on the earth as a neutral party not to soak up its blood when it is spilled, as the earth normally would, to let it remain lying on the surface, thereby serving as a reminder for the avenger of blood, his avenger, to take action to vindicate him. An example or the idea of this may be gleaned from the following passage. Ezekiel 24 verse 7, "For her blood is in the midst of her. She set it upon the top of a rock, so the blood cannot be absorbed. She poured it not upon the ground to cover it with dust." So we are clear that the blood that remains uncovered calls for the avenger of blood to do justice. Likewise, Isaiah 26 verse 21, "Behold, the Lord cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood," the blood of the innocent, "and shall no more cover the slain." It was an ancient Jewish tradition that when the prophet Zechariah was slain, if you go back to 2 Chronicles 24, you will come across this incident where the son of the high priest who served King Joash, was a person named Jehoiada, and his son Zechariah in turn became a prophet. And as a prophet, he rebuked the idol worshipping people who were in Joash's court. And because he rebuked them publicly and put them to shame, they conspired against him and pressurized the king to have this troublesome prophet Zechariah killed. And Joash gave in to the pressure and ordered the murder of Zechariah, and he was murdered in the court of the temple. 2 Chronicles 24, reading from verses 20 through 21 and then 22. "And the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah the son of Jehoiada the priest, which stood above the people, and said unto them," Zechariah said unto them, he rebuked them, "Thus saith God, why transgress ye the commandments of the Lord, that ye cannot prosper? Because ye have forsaken the Lord, he hath also forsaken you." And what was the reaction of these idol-worshipping people in the court? They conspired against him, Zechariah, and stoned him with stones at the commandment of the king Joash in the court of the house of the Lord. Joash himself didn't want to do this, but he was a very weak king. He was not himself an idol worshipper, but because of his weakness of character, he gave in to the pressure from the public, and he ordered the execution of Zechariah. And Zechariah was murdered, as we read in verse 22, 2 Chronicles 24. "Joash the king remembered not the kindness which Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had done to him, but slew his son. And when he, Zechariah, died, he said, the Lord look upon it and require it." This is a reference to the innocent man dying. As he lays dying, he calls for the earth not to cover his blood, so that the blood constantly on the ground would be the inducement, the marker, the indicator, the inducement for the avenger of his blood to take action to vindicate him at some point in the future. Christ himself referred to this murder, as we read in Luke chapter 11 verse 51, "From the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias," that is Zechariah, "which perished between the altar and the temple, verily I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation." According to this passage from Christ's words, Zechariah was slain between the temple and the altar of burnt offering, this being the most sacred part of the court of the priest. So we have essentially completed the penultimate section of chapter 16. Next week, God willing, we do the final section. Despite all that Job has experienced, he's plunged to the depths of despair, he still holds to the fact that his God will one day vindicate him. Job's undying confidence in God.